quest of self-labor. The main reason some could not stand kibbutz life was the lack of personal identification with a piece of land one could call one's own. A splinter group broke off from the kibbutz movement. It was called the Moshav movement. In a Moshav, each man had his own piece of land to work and his own house instead of the communal arrangement. As on the kibbutz, all the civic functions were centrally run, and all the heavy machinery was owned by the entire Moshav. Certain base crops were farmed by the entire community, and there was a central agency which did all the marketing and purchasing. The main difference was the measure of individual freedom and the fact that a man's family was in his own house and he ran his own farm in the way he saw fit. The first Moshav was in the Yisrael Valley and was named after its biblical site, Nahalal, the heritage. The Nahalal pioneers faced the toughest swamp and did a miraculous job of redemption. The drawback of the Moshav movement in the overall scheme was the working for personal profit and the inability of the Moshav to absorb the numbers of new arrivals the kibbutz could. But both movements flourished and grew. As the yeshuv grew, so did the complexities of the community. Barak ben Kanan, a respected elder citizen, was never at rest. Zionism had a bulky machinery, and there were a dozen different political philosophies inside the yeshuv. The dealings with the Arabs became more delicate after the riots, and the dealings with the British became more confusing after their sudden departure from the Balfour Declaration and the Articles of Mandate. Barak's wise counsel was sought in every quarter. Although there were no more outbreaks against the Jews, the atmosphere was one of uneasy calm. Every day there was a new story of an ambush, a sniping, or a theft. The tirades from the Muslim pulpit never ended. There was always tension in the air, for the sinister Mufti, Hajj Amin el-Husseini, lurked in the shadows. One day in 1924, Barak returned to Tel Aviv after a particularly difficult week at the Yeshuv Central in Jerusalem. He was always happy to come home to his three-room flat on Hayarkon Street, overlooking the Mediterranean. This time he was delighted and surprised to see his old friend, Kamal, the Mukhtar of Abu Yesha, awaiting him.
"For many years I have been meditating to try to solve the perplexing riddle of how to help my people. It grieves me to say this, but there are no greater exploiters than the Arab Effendis. They do not want things better for the Fellahin. It may endanger their own pleasures."
Barak listened intently. This was a tremendous confession on the part of an Arab, and one so enlightened as Kamal.
"I have watched the Jews come back and perform miracles on the land. We have nothing in common in religion or language or outlook. I am not even sure the Jews will not eventually take all the land. Yet, the Jews are the only salvation for the Arab people. The Jews are the only ones in 1,000 years who have brought light to this part of the world. I know this is difficult for you to say, Kamal. Let me continue, please. If we can live side by side in peace, although our worlds are far apart, then we must eventually prosper from what you have done. I see no other way for the Arab people, Barak, and I don't know if it is right or wrong. We have never given you reason to doubt our sincerity and wanting peace. Yes, but there are powers greater than you and I who could bring us into conflict against our will."
How true. How very true, Barak thought.
"Barak, I am going to sell the Zion Settlement Society that land by the Hula Lake you have always wanted."
Barak's heart began to beat fast.
"It is not merely benevolence. I have conditions. You must allow the Arabs of Abu Yesha to learn your farming and sanitation methods. This can only be done slowly, over a period of time. I want a portion of the village's more deserving boys to be able to attend your school to learn to read and write.
That will all be done, Barak said. There is one more condition.
And what is that?
You must come too.
Barak rose and rubbed his great beard.
Me? Why me?
As long as you are there, I know the conditions will be kept and that we will be able to live in peace. I have trusted you from the first day you entered Abu Yashar as a boy, over 30 years ago.
I will think it over, Barak said.
And what will you tell Kamal?
Sarah asked. Barak shrugged.
What is there to say? We can't go, of course. What a shame. For years I have been trying to get him to sell that land. Now, if I don't go up there, we will never get it.
It is a pity,
Sarah agreed and poured some tea. Barak paced the floor unhappily.
After all, Sarah, he mumbled, we must face facts. I am needed at the Yishuv Central and the Settlement Society. It isn't as if I was running a candy store on Allenby Road.
Of course not, dear, Sarah said sympathetically. You are vital in your work. The entire Yishuv needs you.
Yes, he said, pacing again, and we aren't children any longer. I am past 50, and the land is going to be very, very hard to redeem.
You are right, Barak. We are too old to pioneer. You have done your share in building this country.
Right. I'll turn Kamal down.
He sank into a chair and sighed deeply. He had not succeeded in convincing himself. Sarah stood over him and smiled.
You are mocking me, woman, he said softly. What's the use?
She sat on his lap and was almost lost in his greatness. His huge hands were amazingly gentle as they stroked her hair.
I was thinking of you and Ari. It will be brutal work, and the hardships will be great.
Shh. Drink your tea.
Barak resigned his position with the Zion Settlement Society, sold his apartment in Tel Aviv, and led 25 pioneer families out to the Hula swamplands to build a moshav. They called it Yad El, the Hand of God. They pitched tents below the fields of Abu Yashar and mapped out their task. No pioneers yet had faced a job so difficult. The Hula swamp was deep and full of forbidding tangles of thickly matted, unyielding brush and papyrus, which towered to heights of 15 feet. The muck was alive with poisonous snakes, scorpions, and rats, and 100 other creatures. Wild boars and wolves lurked near the isolated base camp. Everything had to be brought in on muleback, including drinking and washing water. Sarah was in charge of the base camp, the hospital tent, and the kitchen. Barak headed the work gangs, which took to the swamps daily with shovels and picks. In that first scorching summer, they worked day after day, week after week, and month after month, in 100-degree heat, in waist and neck-high water, slugging away the muck to start drainage channels. With machetes, they hacked at the jungle growth until they couldn't raise their arms. The women worked right in the swamps along with the men. Young Ari Ben Kanan, 10 years of age, one of the 3 children in the settlement, ran off the pails of sludge and ran in drinking water and food to the workers. The work days were 7 each week. The work hours were sunrise to sunset. Still, each night they found the energy to sing a few songs of the fields and dance a hora before their 6 or 7 hours of sleep. At night there was the usual guard against robbers and animals. It was a race to get the channels in before the winter rains. If the water didn't drain off, the summer's work would be wasted. Hundreds of Australian eucalyptus trees were put in to suck up water.
Every kibbutz and moshav in the area sent over as many workers as they could spare each day to help the pioneers. At night, by candlelight, Sarah and Barak took turns schooling Ari and the other two children. The winter downpours came and all but swept the base camp into the swamp. After each downpour, they rushed to the channels to keep the slush from blocking the runoff. Even a man so strong and resolute as Barak Ben Kanan was beginning to wonder if they hadn't attempted too much this time. Each time he looked at Ari and Sarah, his heart bled. They were always covered with bug bites or suffering from dysentery or hunger or thirst. And worse was the ravaging malaria. In that first summer and winter, Sarah had 5 attacks and Ari 4. The chills and fevers and deliriums all but killed them. Ari, like Sarah, took his pain in silence. The swamp broke many of the families. Half the original group quit to return to the city to find an easier way. And soon, Yad El had a graveyard. 2 members died of malaria. Yad El, the hand of God. It may have been the hand of God that led them there, but it was going to be the hands of men that licked the swamp. For 3 solid years, they beat back the swamp. At last, there was enough land to make 25 farms of 200 dunams each. There was no time to gloat, for there were crops to be planted and homes to be built. Young Ari Ben Kanan had shaken off the effects of malaria and the other illnesses and had become as sturdy as a rock. At the age of 14, he could do a man's day's work. When they moved into their cottage and the fields had been plowed and planted, Barak was given a reward for his years of toil. Sarah told him she was pregnant again. At the end of the 4th year, 2 momentous things happened to Barak Ben Kanan. Sarah presented him with a baby daughter who had flaming red hair like his own. The second occasion was the harvest of the first crop at Yad El. At last, the weary pioneers stopped their labor and took time to celebrate. What a celebration it was! Kibbutzniks and moshavniks from all over the area who had lent a hand at Yad El came to join in the celebration. Arabs from Abu Yishak came. There was gaiety for a week, each night ending at dawn as weary hora dancers collapsed with joy. Everyone came to look at Barak's and Sarah's new daughter. She was named Yordana, after the river which flowed past the edge of Yad El. As the celebration continued, Barak took his son Ari and saddled 2 horses, and they rode up to Tel Hai, to that place where he had crossed into the Promised Land from Lebanon 40 years before. Tel Hai, the death place of Joseph Trumpledore, was a shrine of the Yishuv. Barak looked down from the hill to Yad El, as he had sworn he would long ago.
"I took your mother up here before we were married," he said to Ari.
He put his arm around his son's shoulder.
"Someday there will be 2 dozen settlements in this valley, and it will be green all the year around. Look how beautiful Yad El is from here, Father."
The irrigation sprinklers were whirling, and a school was under construction. They could see an enormous shed where the community had put 12 pieces of heavy machinery. There were paths of rose bushes and flowers and lawns and trees. There was sadness, too, for the Yad El cemetery had already claimed 5 members. As Kamal had hoped, the establishment of Yad El had a tremendous effect upon the Arabs of Abu Yishak. The creation of the Moshav was in itself a startling revelation. Barak was true to his agreement and set up special schools for the Arabs to teach them sanitation, the use of heavy machinery, and new farming methods. Their school was open to any Arab youngster of Abu Yishak who would attend. The Yad El doctor and nurse were always at the call of the Arabs. Kamal's favorite son was a youngster named Taha, who was a few years younger than Ari. From the time of his birth, Kamal had ingrained into Taha his own great desire to better the conditions of the Fellahin. As the coming Mukhtar of Abu Yesha, Taha spent more time at Yad El than in his own village. He was the personal ward of the Ben Kanan family. Taha and Ari became close friends. While Yad El and Abu Yesha lived in peace and proved Arab and Jew could exist side by side despite their cultural differences, a slow mantle of fear was falling over many of the other Effendi families in Palestine. They were becoming frightened at the spirit and progress of the Third Aliyah. In the beginning, the Effendis had sold the Jews worthless swamps and rock-filled and eroded hills, eager to get their hands on Jewish gold and certain the land would continue its dormancy. The Jews turned around and performed miracles of redemption. Not only had the farms grown, but cities were springing up all over Palestine. The example of the Jews could be disastrous. What if the Fellahin began demanding education, sanitation, and medical facilities? What if the Fellahin, God forbid, were to take a fancy to the way the Jews governed themselves by equal votes of both men and women? It could well wreck the perfect feudal system of the Effendis. To counter the progress of the Jews, the Effendis harped on the ignorance, fears, and religious fanaticism of the Fellahin. They pounded the theme that the Jews were invaders from the West out to steal their Fellahin's lands, even though the Effendis had themselves sold this land. They maintained tension so that the Fellahin would not come into too close contact with the new ideas. After many years without a major incident, Haj Amin el-Husseini moved again. This time, he concocted a cold-blooded fraud aimed at driving the Arabs wild. The year was 1929. The site of the Dome of the Rock, or the Mosque of Omar, in Jerusalem, was worshipped as holy ground by the Muslims as the point where their prophet Muhammad ascended to heaven. On this very site stood the one remaining wall of the great Jewish temple, which had been destroyed for a second time in AD 76 by the Romans. This wall of the temple was the holiest of all Jewish holy places. Pious Jews gathered before the wall to pray and to weep for the past glory of Israel. From their tears it became known as the Wailing Wall. The Mufti circulated faked pictures showing Jews at the Wailing Wall preparing to desecrate the Arab holy place of the Dome of the Rock. The fanatic Muslim Fellahin started another outbreak supported by Effendi and Husseini Jew baitings. Again, the riots hit the defenseless old Jews of the holy cities. The slaughter was far greater than the Mufti-inspired riots of a decade before. The rioting spread against some of the weaker settlements and onto the roads, and casualties mounted into the thousands on both sides. The British again appeared helpless to stop the slaughter. They sent a commission of inquiry. The commission squarely placed the blame on Arab shoulders. Then, by great paradox, they completely ignored the Balfour Declaration and the Articles of Mandate, and suggested that Jewish land buying and immigration be restricted to soothe Arab fears. Chapter 14. In the same year as the riots, 1929, the farmers of Yad El made an agreement with the grain miller of the Arab village of Ata, some 10 kilometers away. Barak gave Ari the job of going to Ata to have their grain milled. Sarah objected to sending a 14-year-old boy out on the roads alone with the tension of the riots all around. Barak was adamant on the subject.
Neither Ari nor Yordana is going to live in fear like ghetto Jews.
Ari felt very proud of the trust as he jumped onto the seat of the donkey cart. It was loaded with 12 bags of grain. He set out down the road for Ata. He was spotted the instant he entered the village by 12 Arab boys who were lying around near the coffee house. They waited till he turned the corner, then trailed him to the miller's. Ari went about his business, flushed with his own importance. He carried on his transactions in perfect Arabic, which he had learned from his good friend Taha. The grain was crushed to flour. Ari watched closely to make certain that the sacks were filled full and with the same grain, not inferior Arab wheat. The miller, hoping to gain a sack on the deal, was perplexed by the youngster's sharpness. Ari headed back toward Yad El. The Arab boys, who had been waiting, quickly made a deal with the miller to steal all Ari's wheat and sell it to him. The boys scampered out of Ata by a shortcut and set up an ambush and roadblock. In a few moments, Ari rode along the road right into the trap. They sprang out from cover, hurling stones at him. Ari whipped the donkey but moved only a few feet before the roadblock stopped him. He was stoned from the cart and knocked half senseless to the ground. Four of the attackers pounced on him and pinned him down while the others pulled the grain from the cart and made off with it. The boy returned to Yad El late that night. Sarah opened the door, took one look at his blood-streaked face and torn clothing, and screamed. He stood there wordless for a moment, then clenched his teeth and pushed past his mother and went into his room and locked the door. He refused to open it despite her pleas until Barak returned home later from a moshav meeting. He stood before his father.
"I let you down. I lost the wheat," he said through puffed and distorted lips.
"It is I who have let you down, son," Barak said.
Sarah rushed over to Ari and threw her arms around him.
"Never, never, never send this boy out alone."
She led him off to clean him up. Barak did not answer. The next morning after breakfast, before Barak headed for the fields, he took Ari by the hand and led him out to the barn.
"I have neglected some of your education," Barak said, and pulled down his old bullwhip from a peg.
Barak built a dummy and nailed it to the fence. He showed Ari how to judge distance, aim, and swing. With the sound of the first crack, Sarah came running from the house with Jordana in her arms.
"Have you gone mad teaching a boy like that to use a bullwhip?"
"Shut up, woman!"
Barak roared in a tone she had never heard in over 20 years of marriage.
"The son of Barak ben Kanan is a free man. He shall never be a ghetto Jew. Now, get out of here. We have business."
From morning to night, Ari practiced using the bullwhip. He cut the dummy to shreds. He aimed at rocks and tins and bottles until he could whirl around and split them with a flick of the wrist. He threw the whip so often that by the end of each day he could barely lift his arm. At the end of 2 weeks, Barak loaded up the donkey cart with another dozen bags of grain. He put his arm around his son's shoulder and led him to the cart and handed him the bullwhip.
"Take the grain to Ata and have it milled."
"Yes, father,"
Ari said softly.
"Remember one thing, son. You hold in your hand a weapon of justice. Never use it in anger or revenge. Only in defense."
Ari jumped onto the cart and started for the gate of Yad El, toward the main road. Sarah went into her bedroom and wept softly as she watched her son disappear down the road. Barak did something he had not done for many, many years. He sat down and read the Bible. The Arab ambush struck again when Ari was a mile outside Ata on his way back to Yad El. This time Ari's eyes were sharp and his body alerted for danger. Remembering his father's words, he remained cold, calm. As the first rocks flew at him, he leaped from the cart, spotted the Arab leader, and with a lightning flick sent the mighty bullwhip whistling through the air and wrapped it around the boy's neck and flung him to the ground. Then Ari unwrapped the whip and brought down a lash that snapped so sharply it tore his foe's flesh apart. It was all over that quickly. Barak ben Kanan's face paled as the sun began to set and Ari had still not come back. He stood trembling by the gate of Yad El. Then he saw the donkey cart coming down the road, and his face broke into a large smile. Ari stopped for his father.
Well, Ari, how was your trip?
Fine.
I'll unload the flour.
You had better go right in and see your mother. She was worried for some reason or the other.
By 1930, the riots had died down. Abu Yishah and Yad El stayed out of trouble altogether. The majority of villages out of the Mufti's sphere of influence did not participate in the disturbances. Ari ben Kanan was not only built like his father, but acted very like him too. He was deep within himself, and he had Barak's quiet, stubborn ways. He saw the value of learning about his Arab neighbors. Taha was always one of his closest friends, and he treated all other Arabs with understanding and compassion. Ari fell in love with a girl named Daphna, whose family had a farm half a mile away. No one was quite sure when it had happened, but everyone was quite sure that Ari and Daphna would marry someday, for they had eyes only for each other. Little red-headed Jordana was a spirited and rebellious girl. In many ways, Jordana typified the children being born to the settlers of Palestine. Their parents, who had lived in ghettos and had known the fear and degradation of being Jews, were determined to purge this horror from the new generation. They bent over backward to give the children freedom and to make them strong. At the age of 15, Ari was a member of Haganah, the secret army of self-defense. At the age of 13, Daphna could handle half a dozen weapons. For if this was a new generation and a new type of Jew, it was also a generation born with a mission even greater than the missions of the second and third Aliyah. The Haganah had grown strong enough to be a restraining force on the Mufti-inspired disturbances, but they were unable to erase the cause of these riots. Only the British could do that. Again, British commissions of inquiry came, and again the Arabs were whitewashed. British timidity caused the Mufti to grow bolder. Shortly after the riots abated, Haj Amin el-Husseini called a conference of Muslim leaders to Jerusalem. They arrived from all over the world. He formed a federation with himself as head and advertised his fight to save Islam from the British and Jews. The early friendships, the fact that the Jews had raised the standard of living of the entire Arab community, and the fact that Palestine had lain neglected and unwanted for 1,000 years in fruitless despair until the Jews rebuilt it, was all forgotten in the face of the Mufti's tirades. The destruction of the Jewish homeland was made a holy mission of pan-Arabism. The British were subjected to the next tirade. They had lied about granting independence to the Arabs. They supported the Jews against Arabs. And as the Arab demagogues ranted and raged, the British took it all in silence. In the year of 1933, another great calamity befell the Jews as Adolf Hitler and the Nazis ascended to power. Hitler moved first against the Jewish professional people. The wiser ones among them left Germany immediately, and many sought sanctuary in Palestine. Once again, the need for a national home and for Zionism were confirmed. Jew baiting could flare up in any part of the world at any time. Herzl had known it, and every Jew knew it. The German Jews who fled Hitler were different from the ghetto and Eastern European Jews. They were not devout Zionists, but had largely been assimilated into German society. They were not pioneers and merchants, but doctors and lawyers and scientists and artisans. In 1933, the Arab leaders called a general strike of all Arabs to protest the new Jewish immigration. There was an attempt to stir up more rioting, but both efforts failed. Most Arabs who had done business with the Jews continued to do so, for they were economically dependent on one another, and many communities like Yad El and Abu Yishah lived in close harmony with each other. Furthermore, The Haganah stood ready to halt a repetition of the 1929 disturbances. The British solution to the general strike was more talk and more commissions of inquiry. In outright appeasement of the Arab threats, the British this time definitely limited immigration and land selling by the Jews. At the very moment when the Yishuv needed open immigration so desperately, the British forgot their promises. The Yishuv Central, through the Haganah, fought back in the only way they could. Aliyah Bet. The Mufti maintained his pressure on the British until the British sent the Royal Navy out to stop Aliyah Bet runners and to set up a blockade of the Palestinian coast. The strength of Haj Amin el-Husseini grew every day. He found a powerful ally for himself, Adolf Hitler. For the Germans, who had their own aspirations in the Middle East, the situation was perfect. What could be more fortunate for the German propaganda machine than to be able to pump the theme that the Jews of Palestine were stealing the Arab lands just as they had tried to steal Germany? Jew-hating and British imperialism. What music to the Mufti's ears. The Germans were in luck, and Haj Amin el-Husseini saw at long last the instrument for seizing control of the Arab world. German money showed up in Cairo and Damascus. The Germans are your friends. Arab lands for Arab people. Throw out the British and their Jewish henchmen. In many high places in Cairo and Baghdad and in Syria, the Arabs clasped hands with Nazis in friendship. As the storm gathered, the Yishuv still held one trump card, the Haganah. Although this secret army was officially divorced from the Yishuv Central, its existence and strength was an open secret. The Jews pretended it was not there, but the British knew it existed. More important, the Mufti knew it existed. It had grown from nothing to a force of over 25,000 men and women. It was almost entirely a militia, with but a few dozen paid full-time leaders. It had a small but deadly efficient intelligence service, which not only had the open cooperation of many British officers, but could purchase Arab spies for next to nothing. Every city, village, kibbutz, and moshav had its Haganah set up. A secret code word could send 1,000 men and women to hidden arms caches within minutes. Avidan, the bald-headed, square-built ex-soldier who headed Haganah, carefully built it up in a decade and a half under the noses of the British. The efficiency of the organization was terrifying. They ran a secret radio, carried on the Aliyah Bet immigration, and their intelligence network spread throughout the world where agents purchased arms to smuggle back to the Yishuv. Arms were smuggled into Palestine in 100 ways. Hiding them in heavy building equipment was a favorite method. The roller of a steamroller, as often as not, contained 100 rifles. Every crate, piece of machinery, and even food tins and wine bottles coming into Palestine were potential munitions carriers. It was impossible for the British to halt the smuggling without inspecting every item, and many British were turning their backs at the docks to let the arms through. The entire Yishuv was behind the arms smuggling movement. But even so, they could not bring in heavy weapons or sufficient numbers of first-class small arms. Most of what came in were old rifles and pistols, discarded or outmoded in other countries. No arsenal in the world contained the conglomeration of weapons the Haganah had. Every known rifle and pistol was represented in some numbers. 1,000 ingenious varieties of mortars, Sten guns, and grenades were manufactured in secret. The Haganah arsenal even included walking canes, which could fire a single shot. Once inside Palestine, every desk, chair, table, icebox, bed, and sofa was a potential hiding place for weapons. Every Jewish home had at least one false-bottom drawer, hidden closet, trap door, or trick wall. Arms were moved about inside the spare tires of buses and in market baskets and under donkey carts. The Haganah played on British respectability by having the children run weapons and by using the best hiding place of all, under women's skirts. In the building of the Haganah, the kibbutz proved not only the answer to redemption, but the answer to Jewish arms. Because of the communal character of the kibbutz, it was the best place to train young soldiers. A dozen or two dozen could be slipped in easily among 300 or 400 members and absorbed by the community. The kibbutz was the best place to hide the larger arms caches and the best place to manufacture small arms. It was also the best place to absorb newly arrived illegal immigrants. From the kibbutzim came the majority of the outstanding Haganah leaders. The one great strength of the Haganah lay in the fact that its authority was accepted without question by the entire yeshuv. A Haganah command was a positive order. Avidan and the other Haganah leaders were very careful to use their army only in self-defense. When the 1933 general strike broke out, Avidan warned that the Haganah would not try to conquer the Palestine Arabs. "Palestine will be conquered with our sweat." It was an army of restraint. There were many in the Haganah who felt that it should not be held in such restraint. These were activists who demanded swift retribution. Akiva was one of these. Officially, he was a dairy farmer in the kibbutz of Ein Or, but in reality, he was a high man in the Haganah, in charge of all defense in the Galilee. The years had aged Akiva far more than his brother Barak. His face looked tired and his beard was nearly gray. He never fully recovered from the death of Ruth and Sharona. It was a bitterness he carried with him every day of his life. He was the unofficial leader of the fringe element within the Haganah, who demanded more action. As time went on and the trouble heightened, Akiva's group became very militant. Outside Palestine, splinter groups formed from the main Zionist body to support them. When the British threw the blockade along the coast of Palestine, Akiva could stand it no longer. He called a rump session of his supporters within the Haganah. They were all angry men like himself, and they reached a decision that rocked the yeshuv to its core. In the spring of 1934, Barak received an urgent call from Avidan to come to Jerusalem. "A terrible thing has happened, Barak," Avidan said. "Your brother, Akiva, has withdrawn from the Haganah and taken dozens of our top men with him. Hundreds of rank-and-file people are beginning to follow." When the initial shock had passed, Barak sighed. "He has threatened to do that for years. I have been amazed at the restraint he has shown till now. Akiva has been smoldering for decades, ever since our father was killed. He has never recovered from his wife's death." "You know," Avidan said, "that half my work in Haganah is to hold our boys back. If we let them, they'd make war on the British tomorrow. Your feelings, my feelings, and Akiva's feelings are the same. But he can destroy us all. One reason we have been able to achieve what we have in Palestine is that despite our differences, we have acted in unison in our outside dealings. The British and the Arabs have always had to negotiate as though with a single person. Now Akiva has a hot-tempered gang of activists. If they start terror tactics, the entire yeshuv will have to answer for his actions." Barak traveled back north to Ein Or, which was not far from his own moshav of Yad El. Ein Or, like most of the older kibbutzim, had been turned into a veritable garden. As senior member and one of the founders, Akiva had a separate little two-room cottage of his own, which was filled with books. He even had his own radio and toilet, a rarity in kibbutz life. Akiva loved Ein Or, as he had loved Shoshana before it. Barak had wanted him to live with them at Yad El after the death of Ruth and his daughter, but Akiva loved kibbutz life and remained unhealthily with their ghosts. Barak talked softly to his brother. Akiva had heard all the arguments before. He was nervous and restless at the prospect of a showdown with his brother.
So the gentlemen of Yishuv Central have sent you around to cry for them. They are becoming experts at appeasement.
I would have come without their invitation when I heard what an insane thing you have done, Barak said.
Akiva paced the room again. Barak studied him. He was alive with the same angry fire he had had as a boy.
All I am doing is something the Yishuv Central recognizes and is afraid to do. Sooner or later, even they are going to have to face the facts of life. The British are our enemy.
We do not believe that, Akiva. All told, we have done very well under British rule.
Then you are a fool.
I have been wrong before.
The British represent the constituted government of Palestine.
While they cut our throats,
Akiva mocked.
The gentlemen of the Yishuv Central carry their briefcases to conferences and read their little notes and findings and bow and scrape while the Mufti and his cutthroats run wild. Do you see the Arabs negotiating?
We will achieve our aims legally.
We will achieve our aims by fighting for them.
Then if we must fight, let us fight as a unified people. You put yourself in the category of the Mufti by starting a band of outlaws. Have you ever thought of the consequences if the British leave Palestine? No matter how bitter your feelings and mine, the British are still our greatest instrument for achieving statehood.
Akiva waved his hand in disgust.
We will achieve statehood the same way we redeemed this land, with our sweat and blood. I refuse to sit around and wait for British handouts.
For the last time, Akiva, don't do this thing. You will only give our enemies an opportunity to point their fingers at us and increase their lies.
Aha!
Akiva cried.
Now we have come to the guts of the matter. Jews must play the games by the rules. Jews cannot be wrong. Jews must beg and appeal. Jews must turn their cheeks. Stop it! God, no!
Akiva cried.
Whatever you do, don't fight. You wouldn't want the Germans and the Arabs and the British to think you are bad boys.
I said stop it.
Ghetto Jew Barak. That is what you are, and that is what the Yishuv Central is. Well, let me tell you something else, dear brother. Here is one Jew who may be wrong, but intends to live. So let us be wrong in the eyes of the whole damned world.
Barak trembled with rage. He sat motionless to try to hide his anger. Akiva ranted on. Was Akiva really wrong? How much pain and degradation and betrayal and suffering must a man take before fighting back? Barak got out of his chair and walked to the door.
Tell Avidan and the gentlemen of the Yishuv Central and all the little negotiators that Akiva and the Maccabees have a message for the British and the Arabs. An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth.
You are never to set foot in my house again, Barak said.
The two brothers glared at each other for many moments. Tears welled in Akiva's eyes.
Not set foot in your house?
Barak was frozen.
We are brothers, Barak. You carried me to Palestine on your back.
And I have lived to regret it.
Akiva's lips trembled.
I am a Jew who loves Palestine no less than you do. You condemn me for following the dictates of my conscience.
Barak stepped back into the room.
It is you, Akiva, and your Maccabees who have turned brother against brother. Since we were children, I have heard your convenient quotations from the Bible. Well, perhaps you had better read again about the zealots who turned brother against brother and divided Jewish unity and brought on the destruction of Jerusalem by the Romans. Maccabees, you call yourselves. I call you zealots.
Barak again walked to the door.
Remember one thing, Barak Ben Kanan, Akiva said. Nothing we do, right or wrong, can ever compare to what has been done to the Jewish people. Nothing the Maccabees do can even be considered an injustice in comparison to 2,000 years of murder.
Chapter 15. Yad-El blossomed into a Garden of Eden. The Moshav continued to push back the swamps so that its cultivable land was increased to bring in another 100 families. There were 24 pieces of heavy machinery and an experimental station. The entire Moshav worked the fish ponds as a joint crop. The streets of Yad-El were green all year round, and there was a blaze of colors in the spring and autumn. Yad-El had a primary and secondary school, large community center with a swimming pool, library and theater, and a small hospital with 2 full-time doctors. The greatest event of all occurred when electricity was brought in. The celebration throughout the Hula Valley settlements made all other celebrations look small as the lights went on in Ein Or and Kfar Geladi and Ayelet HaShachar and Yad-El simultaneously. In the same year, the Jews of Yad-El helped bring tap water to Abu Yesha, making it the first Arab village in all of Palestine to have it. Yad-El extended some of the electric irrigation pumps into Abu Yesha fields to show the Arabs how to farm intensively through irrigation. To show his gratitude, Kamal gave several dunams of a hillside site to the Zion Settlement Society when he learned the Jews were looking for land in the area for a youth village. Ari ben Canaan was the pride of his father's heart. By the age of 17, he was 6 feet tall and had the strength of a lion. Besides Hebrew and English, he mastered Arabic, German, French, and Yiddish, which Sarah slipped back to in moments of anger or excitement. Ari loved farming. He and Daphna and most of the Moshav's youngsters belonged to a youth group, as did most of the young people in the Yishuv. They would tramp the length and breadth of Palestine to the sites of ancient battles and tombs and cities. They climbed the mountain at Masada, where the Hebrews held out against the Roman siege for over 3 years, and they tramped through the desert over the route of Moses and the 12 tribes. They wore the traditional blue shirts and shorts, and they were always filled with the songs and dances and ideals of the redemption of the homeland. Daphna had developed into a buxom, earthy, attractive girl, filled with love for the son of Barak ben Canaan. It appeared that Ari and Daphna would marry at an early age. They would either open a new farm at Yad-El or travel out with a youth group to begin a new moshav or kibbutz, as was sometimes the tradition after schooling. But as the troubles mounted in Palestine, Ari and Daphna had less and less time to spend together. Ari had shown remarkable skill and leadership within the Haganah, and despite his tender age was considered by Avadan one of the most promising soldiers in all of Palestine. In fact, most of the outstanding soldiers were in their late teens. By the age of 17, Ari had set up defenses at Yad-El, Ein Or, and 6 kibbutzim, and had done so well that he went into Haganah work almost full-time. When the illegal immigration war with the British began, Ari was called to duty at the sites where Aliyah Bet ships beached. Ari worked at getting the illegal immigrants hidden in kibbutzim and at collecting the visas and passports of tourists who had entered Palestine. When he had a day or two free, he would often phone Yad-El, and Daphna would hitchhike to Tel Aviv to meet him. They could hear the new Philharmonic Symphony, which had been formed largely with German musicians and whose initial concert was conducted by Toscanini. Or they could go to the art exhibits or lectures at the youth headquarters, or merely walk along Ben Yehuda Street and Allenby Road, where crowds sipped coffee in the sidewalk cafes. Or perhaps they would stroll along the quiet beaches north of Tel Aviv. Each separation became more and more difficult. Ari did not wish to marry until he could get a parcel of land and build a home. With trouble constant and his services more and more in demand, it seemed as though that time would never come. They loved each other very much. By the time she was 17 and he was 19, she had given herself to him. Now, in their rendezvous, they spent their few hours discovering the wonder of each other. The tension, which began with the German Aliyah in 1933, hit a peak in the year 1935 when the Jews succeeded in bringing in more immigrants than ever before, legally and illegally. Just as the second Aliyah brought ideals and leaders, and the third Aliyah brought the pioneers, the German Aliyah resulted in a tremendous cultural and scientific spurt in the Yishuv. The Effendis, who were watching the continued progress of the Jews, became frantic. Frantic enough, in fact, to unite their dissident political groups for the first time, and as a unified body, make definite demands on the British that all selling of land to Jews and all Jewish immigration be stopped. Early in 1936, Yishuv Central requested several thousand visas from the British to conform with the growing anxiety of the Jews in Germany. Under violent Arab pressure, the British granted less than 1,000 visas. The Mufti, seeing the growing British weakness, made his move at last for control of Palestine. In the spring of 1936, he stirred up a new series of riots. They began in Jaffa with the fable that the Jews were snatching all the Arabs in Tel Aviv and murdering them, and they spread from city to city. As usual, the majority of the victims were defenseless old Orthodox Jews in the holy cities. Immediately after the first outbursts, Haj Amin announced the formation of a higher Arab committee, with himself as head, for the purpose of directing another Arab general strike in protest against the pro-Jewish British policies. This time the Mufti moved after careful preparation. The instant the higher Arab committee was announced, the El Husseini mob, flanked by hired thugs, fanned out throughout the Arab community to enforce the general strike and to see that a full boycott was carried out. A wanton rash of assassinations began systematically to wipe out any known Arab opponent of the Mufti. Although the rebellion was supposedly directed against the Jews and the British, its major objective was to kill off all the Mufti's political opponents. Kamal, the longtime friend of Barak ben Kanan, and the Mukhtar of Abu Yishah, was made to pay for his friendship with the Yishuv. Husseini's henchmen found the aging Mukhtar kneeling at prayer in the little mosque by the stream in his village, and they slit his throat. Taha, the son, was whisked away into Yad El to live in the Ben Kanan home, where he would be safe. The Mufti's blood orgy continued to enforce the general strike and the boycott of the Jews. Without a market, the Arab crops rotted in the fields. The port of Jaffa and the commerce around it ground to a near halt. The strike was paralyzing the Arab population, but they were helpless against the Mufti. Haj Amin El Husseini again used his pulpit to twist the blame upon the Jews. And as the Arab hardship heightened, so did their desperation and anger. Soon the Arabs began to dare to attack settlements and burn fields and steal crops. When an isolated and unarmed Jew was found, his murder was always followed by decapitation, dismemberment, eye gouging, and the most primitive brutalities. As the atrocities increased, Avidan called upon the Yishuv to exercise self-restraint. The Arab population was being victimized, he declared, and no good would come of returning their cruelties. It was a different story with Akiva and the Maccabees. Soon after the Maccabees broke from the Haganah, the British outlawed them and forced them underground. The British, to some extent, turned their backs on the Haganah because they knew about the policy of self-restraint and the fact that the Haganah fought only in self-defense. Furthermore, the Haganah never fought against the British. Not so the Maccabees. They were avowed enemies of the British, and they had no intention of exercising restraint. The Maccabees, therefore, had to move into the cover of the three major cities, Tel Aviv, Jerusalem, and Haifa. Akiva's followers tried to trade terror for terror, but they were not large or effective enough to keep pace with the Mufti's thugs. Although they were officially disclaimed by the Jewish leadership, many of the yeshuv were happy over the Maccabee actions. Once Hajj Amin el-Husseini had his hands on Palestine's throat, he moved ahead with the next phase of his plan. He sent out a fanatically worded appeal for all Arabs of all nations to join the common struggle to liberate Palestine from the clutches of British imperialism and Zionism. Husseini gangsters entered Arab villages and demanded fighters for attacks on Jewish settlements. Most of the beleaguered fellaheen had absolutely no desire to fight, but they were too terrified of the Mufti to refuse. From outside of Palestine came an answer to the Mufti's appeal. An Iraqi army officer named Kawukji saw the Palestine revolt as his long-awaited chance to seize power and make a fortune as the Mufti's military arm. Kawukji was obsessed with himself. His egomania knew no bounds. He purchased many fine new uniforms with all types of fancy decorations and declared himself Generalissimo of the Army of Liberation. With money extorted from the Palestinian Arabs by the Mufti, Kawukji went about recruiting his army outside the country. He got together a band of thieves, dope runners, white slavers, and the like, with the lure of the many Jewish women they could rape and the Hebrew gold they could loot. They were as vicious, degenerate, and brutal a gang as had ever been assembled. Under Generalissimo Kawukji, they poured in from Lebanon to save the great Islam martyr Hajj Amin el-Husseini. Kawukji used safe and simple tactics. He would set up a road ambush after first having made certain of an avenue of retreat. When a bus, unarmed vehicle, or party small enough not to fight passed by, the Arabs would spring, loot, and flee. Soon Kawukji and the Mufti's gangs had the entire country terrorized. The Arab community was defenseless, the British were inept and reluctant to fight, and the Jews would fight only in self-defense. Instead of moving to stamp out the Arab attacks, the British were nearly comical in their efforts. A few times they swept in on suspected bandit hideout villages and assessed collective fines, and once or twice they even destroyed a few villages. But they went into a defensive shell. They built over 50 enormous concrete police forts that encircled all of Palestine. Each fort was capable of holding from a few hundred up to several thousand troops. Each fort was to control its own immediate area. They were designed by a man named Taggart and built by the Jews. The Taggart forts that ringed besieged Palestine were a system as old as the land itself. In biblical days, the Jews used 12 mountains. A fire from one could be seen by the next and relayed to the next. The Crusaders adhered to the same theory by erecting fortified castles, each within sight of the next castle or walled town. Even the Jews now put each new agricultural settlement within sight of a neighbor. At night, the British buttoned up in their Taggart forts and stayed put. By day, their raids were ineffective. The moment a convoy was spotted leaving a fort, the word was passed along the countryside. Every Arab in every field was a potential spy. By the time the British reached their objective, the opposition had disappeared into thin air. Yet, under this unbelievable pressure, the Jews continued to smuggle in immigrants and build new settlements for them. On the first day of a new settlement, several hundred farmers and builders from all the neighboring settlements would gather on the breaking grounds at sunrise. Between sunup and sundown, they quickly constructed a tower with searchlight facilities and generator and a small stockade around it. By night of the same day, it would be completed and they would disappear to their own settlements, leaving the new settlers inside the stockade with a small guard of Haganah men. Ari ben Canaan, just over 20 years of age, became an expert on the tower and blockade settlements. He generally commanded the Haganah unit which stayed behind to teach the new settlers the trick of handling Arab infiltrators and attackers and how to use their weapons. Almost every new settlement underwent an Arab attack. The presence of the Haganah and their ability ultimately to repulse the attackers was a steadying influence upon the newcomers. Not Ari or any other Jewish leader ever lost a tower and stockade settlement. At the end of a few weeks in one place, Ari would take his unit on to the next new tower and stockade settlement under construction. The settlers worked out from the stockades slowly, opening up their land a bit at a time. They erected permanent buildings and slowly expanded into full-fledged villages. If the settlement was a kibbutz, the first building would be the children's house. It was always built in the inner line of defense, so that it would be the last building that could be reached by attackers. Avadan said that the tower and stockade farms were a fulfillment of the biblical story of the rebuilding of Jerusalem, with one hand on the spear and one hand on the trowel. The prophet Nehemiah had said, "Half my servants wrought in the work, and the other half held the spears." And so it was that they worked their land and built their homes with a rifleman behind every plow and every carpenter. The Arabs became so bold that even the British could not go on ignoring the terror. Haj Amin and Kawukchi had made them all look like jackasses. At last, they plunged into action and broke up the Higher Arab Committee and issued a warrant for the arrest of Haj Amin. The Mufti fled ahead of British police into the Mosque of Omar, the holiest Muslim shrine in Palestine. The British balked and dared not enter the mosque for fear of inciting a holy uprising on the part of the entire Muslim world. After a week of hiding out, Haj Amin, dressed as a woman, fled and escaped to Jaffa, where a boat carried him to Lebanon. Everyone breathed a great sigh of relief as the Mufti of Jerusalem left Palestine, especially the Arab community. The riots and attacks abated, and the British again renewed their commissions of inquiry and investigation.